From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. In this hour, we continue analysis of the political shift in the state and the country following last week's midterm election. What are the options open to the Republicans as they've taken back the House of Representatives with their Tea Party partners? How do the Democrats continue with their agenda and prevent a rollback of their accomplishments? What are the hopes of bipartisanship in the new Congress? Our guests today, New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and assistant professor of politics at the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer. Share your takeaway from last week's elections. Politics Day here on The Exchange begins right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day here, Wednesday on The Exchange. And now that things have calmed down a bit since Election Day last week, I want to talk some more about what these election results tell us about the mood of the state, about the country's mood, about what the legislative agenda could be for the next 2 years in Congress, also at a state level, and for that race for the White House in 2012, what we can see at this point. Joining us for the entire hour, Assistant Professor of Politics at the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer joining us. Good afternoon, Professor Larimer.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And then an old hand with us in terms of veteran status is what I mean. New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson, welcome to our program.
Well, my gray hair has increased after the election, so I'm an old hat.
Okay. Listeners, we want to hear from you this hour. Are you more energized or more apathetic following these midterm elections? In what way have you changed politically? 1-866-780-9100 with your takeaway from the 2010 midterm. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. If we could, let's start with the state races. When we look at Iowa, Terry Branstad returning to the governor's mansion. He returns the governorship to GOP hands. And in the state legislature, official results in two key races yesterday mean the Democrats will retain control of the Iowa Senate only by one vote. And that will make it trickier for Republicans to push through spending cuts, other agenda items. Republicans control the House, though, by a significant margin. They will have a 60-40 majority in the House, 22 freshman Republicans. Now that we've had a few days to look at the results of these state races, I'd like to hear some observations, starting with you, Chris Larimer. What are the highlights for you when we look at the state results?
Well, I think the state results tend to track what was going on nationally in terms of a big shift to Republican control. I think within the state, it was interesting to see just the domination by the Republican Party in terms of, you know, the number of seats won in the Iowa House, kind of the biggest win for, or biggest loss for Democrats since I think it was 1966, and the number of Republicans who were running unopposed and the number of Democrats who had very contested and very competitive races. So I think it was just a case of a lot of evidence for a big Republican shift.
Chris, that it means I think I hear you saying we could have seen this coming or not.
Yes. Yeah, I think we could have seen this coming. If you looked at the races, you know, in the 3 to 4 weeks before the election, the writing was on the wall.
Mm-hmm. And your observations, Arnie Arneson?
Well, we had a very similar picture in the state of New Hampshire, except remember, we do everything in larger numbers. So we have 400 members in our New Hampshire House. So when you realize that you have 400 members in the state that has 1.3 million people, the Democrats saw a loss of over 100 seats.
Wow. All those going to the Republicans?
All those going to the Republicans. But the reason I want to share that number with you is that if you look across the country, 650 Democrats lost their seat in state legislatures across the 50 states, but New Hampshire contributed 100 of those. So just to give those numbers some perspective. But New Hampshire and Iowa were very important to the Republican Party. I think you're absolutely right. A number of weeks ago, we knew Republicans were going to do very well across the nation. We knew Republicans were going to do very well in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. But what you need to know is that I think they really focused very hard on these two states. because the Republican Party is going to rebuild and regroom in Iowa and New Hampshire. This is a place where they strut their presidential candidates. This is a place where they want to have offices where their candidates can sit and meet and greet. And it's very important that the numbers be very strong here. And in New Hampshire, it was an across-the-board romp for Republicans from at every single office except for governor. Which is interesting. And let me just share with you why the governor, I think, in part, was able to retain his seat. Yes, he's a Democrat. Yes, he ran for a fourth unprecedented term, although we have two-year terms for governor, so they're kind of a hiccup. But one of the things that's interesting is the retiring senior senator from New Hampshire, Senator Judd Gregg, someone that's very familiar to all of us, his chief of staff endorsed the Democratic governor. Isn't that fascinating?
Hmm.
And the only person to remain standing, for the most part, on the Democratic side of the aisle was that governor. So, again, it's a very, very interesting landscape. I think people expected it, but I think the numbers were bigger than most of us expected.
Chris Larimer, Arnie mentioned the building, rebuilding of the GOP. We've, mm-hmm. We've seen a return of many former Republican players at our state level in Iowa, not only Terry Branstad, but some people in the legislature, Stu Iverson, Sandy Griner.
Yep.
What does this tell us about the state of the Republican Party within Iowa?
I think within Iowa, they're... You know, they saw this as a year to make big gains, and they wanted to, you know, bring out the most consistent candidates, the candidates they felt the most comfortable with.
But we're returning to a status quo. We're not moving into a Tea Party future. We're going to moderate Republicans.
Right, absolutely. And, yeah, and I think that was their key. They saw 2010 as a year. We should make gains. Let's bring out moderate Republicans to make sure that, you know, we are picking up these seats. We don't want to bring out, excuse me, extreme Republicans that are potentially not going to win a seat that normally a moderate Republican would pick up. And, you know, particularly in the Iowa House, you look at – they had that the so-called Democratic six-pack in the Iowa House, kind of these conservative Democrats. You saw relatively moderate Republicans running against those six individuals, and those moderate Republicans were able to pick up five of the six seats.
Mm. Mike Ronstadt, the majority leader in the Senate, has said Democrats are willing to work with Republicans on creating jobs in Iowa, but has vowed to block any attempt to start the process for a constitutional amendment vote to ban same-sex marriage.
Right.
Chris, the implications of that, first of all, and then I'd like to turn to you, Arnie, to see if the ousting of the three Iowa Supreme Court justices had made any news out east. But first, Chris, go ahead. The implications there.
Well, I think the implications are that, you know, the House will act on it, will try to pass an amendment banning same-sex marriage. But as you said, Gronstall and the Senate have said that they're not going to do anything. And I think if you look at the governor's office and the governor's reaction there, I think it's an easy out for Branstad. He can just say, we'll leave it to the state legislature. The House will act on it. The Senate doesn't. And he doesn't really have to deal with the issue.
Arnie, has this news of the Iowa Supreme Court justices made any news out there in the East?
Absolutely. I mean, remember, this is the place where so much of this activity started because of the state of Massachusetts. So that really was the first state where you saw that the judiciary, you know, step in and weigh in on this. Iowa also saw the judiciary weigh in on this. New Hampshire is unique in the states that have embraced gay marriage. Why? Because the New Hampshire legislature, with no court involvement, embraced the concept of gay marriage. What you need to know is, with this huge change, this sea change in the New Hampshire House, one of the first bills that's going to be introduced in the New Hampshire House is the repeal of gay marriage. And in some ways, it's going to be a lot easier for them to do that, not only because they have overwhelming control of the House, overwhelming control of the Senate, but they have numbers where they are now veto-proof, because the governor could veto that because he signed the first gay marriage bill, but then they, in fact, can do an override. We saw what happened in Iowa with the justices and what happened with the Supreme Court justices, and it definitely told us that there was a tremendous sentiment about gay marriage. The question is, was that reflective of the state of Iowa, or was that reflective of outside sources? And that's really the question here. In the state of New Hampshire, we did not vote on gay marriage when they ousted all those Democrats. But no sooner did the Republicans come in, and it was supposed to be jobs only and the economy stupid, and yet the first headline in the Union Leader was, gay marriage may no longer be in our future.
Okay. What's your takeaway, Exchange listeners, from this 2010 midterm election? 1-866-780-9100, the Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Let's first go to Des Moines, where James is listening. Good afternoon, James. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon. I think that Republican branding and misinformation had a huge effect on the election, both in Iowa and across the nation. The fact that they threw out three Supreme Court justices for following the law and believing the lies that Bob Vanderplas and spewed, and the ability to get that on media because of the outside funding as well as inside funding within the state. And it's just a matter of branding. Obamacare, the death tax, all of those are mislabeled. And the fact that we want to restore the tax cuts for everybody but the top 15% of the wage earners, the income level, I just think that we've lost on the message when we have the better programs, speaking as a Democrat.
Interesting comment, James from Des Moines. Let me throw this to Chris. When we talk about getting your message across with the terms that James mentioned there, too, do you feel that the Republicans are more effective at this or have been recently?
Yes, I think they are more effective, and they have been more effective recently. What the Republicans are able to do, and there's more and more research coming out about this, is their ability to create strong emotional messages. Democrats, when they tend to try to present their messages, maybe a little more, present a little bit more detail in their messages, and really aren't able to get this sort of unifying frame when presenting their messages to the voters. Republicans, on the other hand, can present these very simple, very emotional appeals, and that's what appeals to voters, and that's what drives voters' decisions.
Okay.
Chris, can I just respond
sure,
to that?
Sure, go ahead.
Because let me remind you, when I say no to taxes, do I have to define that for you?
No.
When I say no to government, do I have to define that for you? When I say no to regulation, do I have to define that for you? The problem with Democrats, especially in the 2010 election, is they couldn't even find the words to explain the yeses they had done. Most of them are holding their nose on health care. Most of them are holding their nose on the regulation of the financial industries. Most of them are holding, because it wasn't even the yes they liked. So the problem is that yes includes detail. Because you have to explain what the regulation looked like.
Yeah. Okay. So can our electorate handle nuance, Arnie?
Well, you know what? I think what has to happen is that it's not just about nuance. It's reminding the electorate about how they live their lives. And it would be lovely if their lives were based on no and yes. And in reality, they're not. And what I think the Democratic Party has failed to do is to remind the American people about how complicated the decisions are, whether it's the decision to buy a house, whether it's the decision to have a child, whether it's a decision to go to school, how complicated they are. And so, therefore, as the economy was tanking, the no's were easier to understand because the yeses were so hard, because there is no easy yes to an economy that's in free fall.
Chris Larimer, could the Democrats have done a better job at delivering their message in the way that context that we're talking about?
Yes. I think, and what Arnie's getting at is exactly right, that they could have just presented a simpler message and could have presented a message that hit home a little bit earlier. They just had trouble coming up with a solid message that could fit on, a small 2x3 placard or some small sign. They just couldn't do that, and Republicans could.
Okay, let's reach out to our Exchange listeners to see what they think. 1-866-780-9100, the Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, IPR Talk on Twitter. Let's go to Des Moines once again. Jeffrey's listening. Good afternoon, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think Goebbels would probably appreciate this conversation as we sit around and see who's the best, discuss who's the best propagandist, the Republicans, the Democrats. But I think one thing you're missing is that a study was just done that said for every 2,500 minutes that right-wingers have on radio, moderates or liberals have 200 minutes. And I think the equation is about 80-20 on television. So I think if you dominate radio and you dominate television, and maybe newspapers are 50-50 on the editorial page, I know the most published syndicated columnists are George Will, Crossomer, Kel Thomas, and some others, and those are hardly liberals. I think that level of domination helps you to get your message out. Beyond having a better message, if I have 2 hours to explain my position to somebody as opposed to somebody who has 3 minutes, probably my 2 hours will probably be more effective. The other thing I would say is I guess I'm just very discouraged, and I think anymore I'm more upset with our situation of our mass media. I wish we had a free and independent press, but increasingly we have, you know, a few companies who own everything and are just selling us entertainment, and we don't seem to be talking about the issues of this country anymore. And while it seems like a lot of the world is kind of moving on and, you know, building bullet trains and clean energy futures, et cetera, now we have the Republicans who are basically coming in saying we're going to give a $1 trillion tax cut to millionaires and we're going to fire public sector workers. And I just have no idea how this is going to help us deal with the many crises before us. I would just say someday I even hope National Public Radio lives up to its billing of having more controversial views and a larger segment of people talking about the issues that actually affect real people as opposed to this sort of theater critic, what the two parties should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for your view, Jeffrey. Let's talk a little bit about Jeffrey's last point there, that the role of the media. Chris Larimer, could we have a better discussion in the media?
I think so, but again, I think it gets back to the point we were talking about earlier with Arnie is, you know, it's tough to think in terms of complications. It's tough to think about in terms of details. You know, when you think about the voter going into that, into the voter booth, you know, they have just a few minutes to make those decisions, or they're usually in a rush. If they can think of a single word, you know, for instance, in this election, you know, Obamacare, or a phrase, you know, government takeover, that's going to be what's driving the voter's decision. So, yes, we can have that discussion. But when it boils down to it, as far as actually getting in the voting booth, the simple message usually wins out.
Okay. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange. And joining us today, Assistant Professor of Politics at the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer, along with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. President,
can I respond to the last caller, Ben? Because he hit home with me in a way I'm not sure he quite understood. And that is one of the reasons why he's so distraught about the media and about the number of hours that you hear people on the radio from a conservative bent versus the other side, what's happening on cable TV versus the other side, is that adults are very much like children, and we learn by repetition. And when you have someone like a Rush Limbaugh or a Glenn Beck or whatever, they have not only an opportunity to talk to you, but they have an opportunity to talk to you 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, sometimes 5 hours a day in different settings, whether it's the TV Glenn Beck or the radio Glenn Beck. And as a result, repetition is how you imprint. It's how you learn. And yes, it would be wonderful to have a full-throated conversation on National Public Radio, but that would happen 1 hour a week, and they wouldn't touch the subject for another 2 weeks. And then they would get back to it again. So part of the problem is that there is no place where you can have that conversation, but you can also repeat the conversation. You don't learn it the first time. You don't believe it the first time. You need to hear it in sort of all different forms. Some of us need to read it. Some of us need to hear it. Some of us need to see it. And I think the problem right now in the media is that none of that has happened, so that we really are working in more of a vacuum of information, except for this highly charged emotional stuff that is repeated constantly and now has become the norm of the land.
Okay, Arnie Arneson with us. Let's go to our caller in Mount Vernon, Bill. Good afternoon, Bill.
Good afternoon. I'm a progressive and proud of it, and I really think what's happened in the recent election is playing into our hands for 2012. I really think the Tea Partiers are going to have to put their money where their mouth is. I think because of the way the election turned out, I think there's going to be a lot of even more gridlock, not just between Democrats and Republicans, but within the Republican Party. So I really see things going our way, and I'm very, very happy and optimistic about it.
Okay. Bill, let's get a reading from Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. I want to have your read on the next session of Congress, the lame duck session, how the GOP will work together with its new Tea Party partners.
Well, I think they're going to have to work with them a little bit, but I think the caller was absolutely right that they have to be a little bit careful about not going over the edge and catering to a particular segment of their party. They do have to think about 2012. They do have to think about, you know, running a national campaign, the presidential campaign. So, yeah, if they decide to go too extreme, you know, that makes it that much easier for the Democrats.
Arnie Arneson, I want to ask you this question. It's been batted around for the past week in many places. Could the GOP have taken back both houses instead of just the House of Representatives without Tea Party involvement?
Probably not. And let me tell you why. The Tea Party was important because it jazzed up a certain segment of the base that came out in incredible numbers. Remember, elections are not rule by the majority. They are rule by the activated minority that shows up. And what you saw was that what the Tea Party did was really add sizzle for a Republican Party that, while it may have had some of the issues on its side because the economy was still tanking, was not going to create the same kind of excitement. So the asset to the Republican Party was the Tea Party. The liability to the Republican Party is the Tea Party. You know, it cuts both ways. And I don't think that I understand what you're asking, like Christine O'Donnell, you know, what would have happened if she wasn't there?
Sharon Engel, right, yeah.
Don Engel, there's a lot of what ifs, but at the same time, you also have to ask yourself, did they do enough to stir the pot, to get the excitement out there, that they ultimately made a significant difference in Republican majorities, not just in Congress, but in legislatures across the country?
Chris Larimer, anything to add to that analysis?
No, I think Arnie's right, and I haven't quite been able to come across it yet, but I would be interested to see the number of first-time Republican voters because of the Tea Party.
Yeah.
We know we always talk about 2008 first-time Democratic voters because of Barack Obama. I'd like to see that for this election cycle.
Let's squeeze in one more call before our break at 5:30. Sam is with us from West Branch. Sam, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wanted to comment on what I think is essential, and that's leadership, effective leadership. And fine, there can be all sorts of reasons why it's difficult to achieve. But to me, this has been a leadership crisis from the White House. And that's been brought back to me a couple of ways. One, Michelle Obama, the First Lady's campaigning for Harry Reid, and she said, this is not was not about putting one man in a White House. This is about a movement. And it struck me because I had heard before a movement. I heard the president tell the Republican caucus, I'm not an ideologue. And I've never heard of a movement that didn't have an ideology. And to me, it's just been the president has served as the chairman of a board or something. I don't know. People voted for change. We know we need real solutions. And I haven't seen leadership at all. And in contrast to that, George W. Bush, who became unpopular, said, I'm going to spend my political capital. Remember, he was not too popular. He did win the election, but that's what he said when he was faced with his political disaster. To me, we haven't had leadership. We've had somebody sitting around the table trying to encourage everyone to be nice, and boy, that sure worked. And we've passed off legislation that is a ball of wax, a meaningful string of this and that, is health care and that. And we haven't addressed the fact that times have changed and there are real problems that need real solutions.
Okay, Sam.
And part of them is energy and mass transit and things like that.
Sam.
And not all smiling around singing kumbaya.
Sam.
I happen to be a Democrat.
Very good. We appreciate your comments. Thank you for those insights. We're going to take a break and come back, comment on what you said. Also, President Obama's trip abroad. What does his popularity have to do with his popularity in the country, in the U.S.? Also, George W. Bush with his book out on the media circuit. We'll talk about that when we come back. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and professor of politics at the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer. Back in just a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on The Exchange over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer here on Iowa Public Radio's news stream. Many veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are taking advantage of the GI Bill to go to college, but veteran graduation rates at the University of Iowa are 15% lower than rates for non-veterans. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about a new class aimed at helping veterans stay in school. Life After War builds on the camaraderie and teamwork learned in the military to help student veterans to overcome PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and other barriers to graduation. Tomorrow on our program, Thursday, on The Exchange over the noon hour today. It's our Politics Wednesday. Our guests today, New Hampshire political analyst Arne Arneson, assistant professor of politics at the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer, and we'd like to include your opinion. Where do you find yourself now, a little more than a week after the 2010 midterm elections? More energized, more hopeful, or more apathetic? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. I wanted to start this half hour off by talking about President Obama's trips abroad. He arrived last night after spending less than a day in Indonesia, where he lived for 4 years as a boy. He's in South Korea on the third stop on his four-nation economic and goodwill tour of Asia. Authorities in Seoul have ramped up security for this week's G20 summit with 10,000 participants, including 32 heads of government, leaders of international organizations that are expected in the South Korean capital. And I want to reach out now and ask, while the president's approval rating has taken a beating at home, he remains very popular around the world outside of the U.S.'s borders. And Chris Larimer, can you clue us into why there is such a mismatch between his popularity at home and abroad?
Well, I think the popularity abroad is in part just a contrast to the previous administration. I mean, we know that President Bush was very unpopular abroad, and so really, you know, there was a lot of support. Obama, during his presidential campaign, was talking about reaching out to a number of nations, and so that and he's tried to do that.
But
every time, oh, I'm sorry.
Just to point out that George W. Bush's popularity sank at home, but also sank abroad.
Right, but and I guess with Obama, you know, it was a change in terms of the approach, the process to talking with other nations. I mean, it was very much an open dialogue. It was not, here's what we're going to do, and you guys can follow or not. It was, here's what we'd like to do, and we're interested in what you have to say. And then with Obama's approval rating going down here at home in the United States, every time he goes abroad, it's seen as, oh, well, he's not focusing on the economy, he's not focusing on the jobs. So that's really the mismatch.
Mm-hmm. Well, Arne Arneson, yeah, go ahead.
A couple of things. Let's remember. One of the first things was he gave that speech in Cairo. Let's remember that one of his first visits to the White House was the head of state from India. He has always had a very international sort of he's comfortable on the international scene because that's where he was raised. I mean, he was raised in Indonesia. The world was his oyster. George Bush was very clumsy on the world stage. I don't think he could always identify those places on the world stage. So I think part of it is that Barack Obama really made an olive branch to the Islamic community. He gave that speech in Cairo. Going back to Indonesia, they're so excited. It's the country that has more Muslims than any other country in the world. You really do see the sense of hope. And even in India, I think it's interesting because most Americans view India as the place where their job was outsourced. Am I right? That's how 99% of us think of
it. Sure, we get them on the 1-800 helplines, that's for sure.
Exactly. Right. But yet India is so terribly, terribly important. It's important because of the balance of power between China and India. It's important because of what it means potentially to economic activity in the United States. Can I give you two statistics about India that I think every American needs to hold on to? Because it is an important economic trading partner. And that is, one, there are more middle-class people in India than there are Americans. Okay? Just middle, that gives you the size of India. I mean, and India still has a huge poor population, but that's the size of its middle class. And then I just saw this statistic this morning. I'm reading like the Hindu Times, and it turns out that India is adding 6 million mobile cell phone users a month. A month. So I just want folks to understand that part of the reason why he's gone to India and part of the reason why he's making this trip is not only because he feels comfortable in that setting, but if there is going to be hope for the United States to recover economically, it is important for us to have export partners. It's important for us to see nations like India develop because it'll take some of the pressure off of us to consume everything that's being made in China and being made in Germany and being made all over the world.
Do we see any evidence that Americans give any credit to their president for being popular outside the country, a world statesman, or does that not count whatsoever when it comes to his approval rating among the electorate, among the people who vote him, vote on that every 4 years. Chris Larimer.
I think it counts as long as they approve of what he's doing here in the United States, as long as the economy is okay and jobs are okay. I think it counts. And back to Arnie's point about, you know, the importance of what President Obama is doing abroad, I also expect that as we get closer to 2012, we'll see fewer trips and perhaps his approval rating abroad go down because he's making less of an effort to make international trips because he has to focus on the 2012 campaign here.
Thomas in Windsor writes us an email. Windsor Heights writes, right now I feel beaten down because of the sheer volume of political ads. It's exhausting to live in Iowa, writes Thomas in Windsor Heights. Now, it is. I mean, we have just finished with a 2010 election campaign. How soon before the campaign for the White House, the caucuses in Iowa, ramp up into full bloom? Chris Larimer.
It hasn't. Are you saying it hasn't started yet? Is that what?
Well, I guess, yeah. Knowing that it already has, I guess I put the question out there that way.
Right. You know, but I think you'll start to see it immediately. You're already starting to see commentary about which candidate, given the election in Iowa, which presidential candidate on the Republican side is going to play well. Because really, Iowa sent two mixed messages. One, we said no to three Supreme Court justices based on the gay marriage ruling. The other side of it is we have people coming into office who are very much moderate Republicans, kind of the Terry Branstad, the Stu Iverson type Republicans. And so if you're a presidential candidate, if you're Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney, you can look to Iowa and both of you can say, hey, there are signs there that maybe my candidacy would play well.
Mm-hmm. So in Iowa, and I want to go to Arnie to talk about New Hampshire, Iowa and New Hampshire being leadoff states here. What are the names that are doing best in Iowa?
Well, can I just respond to that first point, though, from your the email? And that's this, and that the reason why you're not going to see a slowdown in the onslaught of advertising that is going to look and feel very much like political advertising is that millions, if not who knows, maybe even a billion, was spent on this election cycle by 501c3 nonprofits where 50%, I think it's C3 or C4, 50% of their money could be spent on direct political advertising. But then 50%, an exact same amount, must be spent on what's called educational information. So what you will see in places like Iowa and New Hampshire and around the country are a lot of ads, but they're going to appear more generic. They're going to talk about bad health care reform, and they're going to talk about terrible idea of getting rid of the tax cuts. So you're going to see a lot of ads because they have to spend the money. They have to spend the money. That's what the IRS requires them to do. And since they spent so much in this election cycle, the only way they can compensate is if they continue to spend so much, but it's going to be in sort of an academic educational field, but it's going to really sound incredibly political and very, very conservative and Republican.
Arnie Arneson, in New Hampshire, there's some early polling, I think, about the likely candidates in 2012. What is that polling telling you?
Oh, yuck. Oh, excuse me. It means that we're close to Massachusetts and probably a guy named Romney owns a summer place in New Hampshire.
Okay. He's polling very well.
Hmm? He's polling incredibly well. But he's the only name we could pick out of a hat. I mean, if there were, you know, 10 people in a lineup, it would be very easy to pick up, you know, Mitt Romney's name. He breeds familiarity. That does not guarantee you a win in places like New Hampshire. I'm going to point to Obama and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton may have pulled it out on the last day of the primary in New Hampshire, but trust me, nobody knew who Barack Obama was. Everyone knew who Hillary Clinton was because she was in everybody's house for the last decade. So, again, I understand what the early polling means. I don't think it has any indication of what ultimately is going to show up and win in New Hampshire.
Chris Larimer, anything to say about polling in Iowa this early on?
I think this early on, so far everything I've seen has said, you know, Romney, Huckabee, Gingrich, and Palin are still the top four. You're starting to see more with Pawlenty because he's making more stops in Iowa. He's starting to hire staffers in Iowa. So, you know, it's probably those four or five still grouped pretty closely together. And just one other point on that negative advertising. You know, that's really what has been driving down approval of government, trust in government. And so you know, if Arnie's right, and I think she is, that, you know, we go up to 2012 and we continue to see that big increase. Approval of government, trust in government is going to continue to be extremely low.
The New York Times reporting today that some senior Republican Party officials are maneuvering to put pressure on Michael Steele, the controversial party chairman not to seek re-election when his term ends in January, and failing that to encourage a challenger to step forward to take on Michael Steele. I would like to get your thoughts on the analysis of Michael Steele, his legacy as a GOP party chairman, and why the GOP might want to move on to a new chairman. Arnie.
Well, actually, I think that you keep Michael, because then they will be able to say that they are a party of diversity. And the reason I say that is that the Republican National Committee was not the place that doled out the cash. The cash that went to Republicans across the 50 states came from many other sources, and they did not need the RNC because of Citizens United, corporations, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, all those nonprofits I was talking about, Crossroads GPS, whatever it's called, they were the source of money. So what you get with Michael Steele is you get diversity and no real sort of credibility, but that's fine because they don't really want to turn to the Republican National Committee for credibility because they have so many other places now, thanks in part to the Tea Party, that doesn't necessarily believe in one head. They like many heads. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's exactly what we've created as a result of Citizens United.
Chris Larimer, do you think so? If you were in the GOP strategist's shoes, would you hold on to Michael Steele for diversity's sake?
Yes, I think that's a valid point. You want to hold on to him for diversity's sake. That's fine. But he was also in a tough position in that, you know, they had this overwhelming kind of national wave moving toward the Republican Party, and you kind of had every single Republican saying, "Okay, this is my year. This is when I should win. Why aren't you helping me more?" And so it was a good year for him, but he also had to answer to a number of different people, and I think that makes it tough.
Okay, let's go to back to the phones. Mike is joining us from Shenandoah. Mike, good afternoon and welcome.
Yeah, hi. My concern about American politics, and I think it's evidenced by your program, is that we seem to have a dichotomy between the public sector and the not-for-profit sector, and then the business community and the for-profit sector. And I happen to be one of that 1% that if I got my tax cut, I'd keep the money and put it back into my business. And I tell you that I would make jobs because my business would grow. And the level of conversation that I hear from your guests seems to have contempt for any private or private sector solutions, and only sees the world in terms of public sector solutions. And I think that's, I think that's a problem. I think the public sector guys talk to public sector people, and they all agree with each other.
You think
and
you see
the business community tends to talk to itself, and we all agree with each other. And I don't hear a lot of conversation that goes back and forth.
Okay, Mike, thank you for that comment. What do you think of Mike's comment, sort of saying they're two separate echo chambers, and how do you accomplish anything when that's the case? Chris Larimer.
Well, I think Mike is partly right, and I think you're in a state like Iowa and many states across the country where you have, you know, tough economic times, the states have to deal with this, and they're starting to find these public-private partnerships. And so hopefully that conversation is going on, but you know, I think Mike's right that both camps kind of seem to be talking to themselves. But I do think there is hope. I mean, when you have severe budget crisis like this, it forces government leaders to think about innovation, think about creativity. And if you look at it across states and even within localities, you're seeing many more public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm. Arnie Arneson, you're...
Well, let me just give you an example. Let's talk about health care reform. You know, the Republicans are now talking about rolling back health care reform, and you hear what appears to be some kind of an applause line from the business community, except you should call the insurance community, because all of a sudden the health insurance community says, don't you dare roll it back. Are you kidding us? This is a bonanza for private health insurance. We've already started to put together the packages. We see the cash. We're going to start hiring people. So I just want everyone to remember that we really do public-private partnerships, and sometimes they're very successful. Wall Street is a perfect example of public-private partnerships. They basically, you know, fall apart, and then the public comes and rescues them and props them up again. That's where your tax dollars went. Your tax dollars did not go to a federal employee. Your tax dollars went to Wall Street. Your tax dollars went to places where when they saw the banks imploding and Lehman Brothers imploding, they had to come in and rescue them. Is that a public-private partnership? What do we call that?
Mac in West Union has an interesting email, and you can certainly hear exasperation when you read between the lines of this. The electorate has become a load of spoiled brats. If it isn't fixed, whatever it is at the moment, right now, they toss it to the other side. I expect this back and forth to continue for the foreseeable future. Mike in Shenandoah, thank you for that email. Coming up on the end of our hour, I wanted to share the poll results brought out. The Iowa poll a year ago showed 43% of Iowans considering themselves to be conservative, 36% moderate, and 17% liberal. Now, in that poll, about half of Iowans describe themselves as economic conservatives, while 42% describe themselves as social conservatives. In the latest Iowa poll, taken a week before these elections, it showed that almost half of likely voters, a 48%, describe themselves as conservative. So we have a jump in this self-description as a conservative. What does that increase in Iowans describing themselves as conservative tell us, Chris Larimer?
Well, I mean, I think it tells us in part what we already know, in that, you know, people don't like to be branded as liberal. For the most part, when you ask people, they're more than happy to say, yes, I'm conservative or I'm a moderate. And so I think part of that is just the way you ask survey questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other part of it is there is a little bit of a shift to moderate conservatism or, you know, a moderate Republican. You know, if you look at party identification, it tends to follow that, right? We had in 2006 and 2008, we had massive increases in the number of registered Democrats up to 33-34%. And then just before the election, we had a drop of 3 percentage points for registered Democrats and an increase of about 2.5 percentage points for Republicans and the rest going to independents. And what that tells me is that basically people are shifting away from Democrats to be more conservative, and that seems to be kind of the ideal point for Iowa. I mean, if you look mm-hmm. across Iowa, you see kind of the eastern half is, you know, fairly Democratic, the western half is fairly Republican, but I think for the most part, most of the state is what they would self-describe as conservative.
Now, a Republican pollster or strategist would say that's because of a Democratic overreach in mm-hmm. recent years. Chris Larimer, would you agree with that?
Democratic overreach in terms of policy?
In terms of policy being put before the legislature.
I think in part, and I think part of it was the fact that, you know, we had 2006, we had Democrats in control of the governor's mansion and control of both houses for the first time in mm-hmm. 42 years, and they were expecting big change, and they didn't see it. They saw, you know, a big shock to the economy, a big downturn in the economy, a number of scandals at the state level, and so I don't know if it's necessarily government overreach or maybe what they perceived as government mismanagement.
Arnie Arneson, what is your comment on Iowans describing themselves as more conservative than they did just a year ago?
I think when you see an economy tanking, you're angry at government. When you see an economy doing well, you don't notice government. It's unbelievable to me. I always describe government as kind of like your mother and your father. That you, like, when you're really happy, you never call your mom. When you're really miserable, you're calling your mom all the time. And and so the problem is government gets the shaft either way. You don't give it credit for an economy that's humming and a tech boom and your 401ks, you know, rolling in cash, but you do blame government when the economy is going down. It's very tough to be someone who thinks that there's a role for the public sector because no one ever quite acknowledges that the public sector does anything good.
Well, and I think, if I could, Ben, follow up.
Sure.
The other part of that is when the economy is doing poorly, that's when we see the process of government at work. And we know that when we talk to people, the process is the thing that most upsets people. They don't like to see the constant bickering. They don't like to see the constant debate. And when the economy goes down, that's when you're going to see all that, and that's what's going to drive sort of that disapproval of government.
Okay.
And when the economy goes down, Chris, remember, too, that usually the most successful lobbyists, the largest institutions, get the first handout and they get the biggest check. And by the time they get to you who just lost your house or just lost your job, oh, I'm sorry, but we can't afford your unemployment benefits. Oh, I'm sorry, your house is
right.
going to be foreclosed on. And they're looking at the billions that just went to people who are now getting bonuses,
right.
and they're looking at the pittance that came to them as they lose their house and they don't collect their unemployment benefits. That's the problem. There are more of them than the handful of very, very wealthy executives on Wall Street, except those executives on Wall Street benefited from the largesse of government and nobody else did.
Okay, our hour has come to an end. I want to thank you very much. Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire political analyst. Thank you, and we'll talk to you again soon, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. Ciao.
Ciao. Assistant Professor of Politics at the University of Northern Iowa, Chris Larimer, for the first time on our program. We hope you enjoyed it. We'd love to have you back at some point in the future.
I'd love to be back. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Okay, Chris Larimer, thank you very much. And we want to remind you that tomorrow on this program, we're going to be talking about a new class aimed at helping veterans stay in school. It's called Life After War. Builds on the camaraderie and teamwork learned in the military to help student veterans to overcome PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and other barriers to graduation. That's tomorrow, Thursday, here on The Exchange on the 11th of November. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance today from Lindsay Moon, technical support from Dennis Reese. And in Cedar Falls, we also had help today from Phil Moss. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.